and I went for a hike near Mary Knoll Seminary. In a nature preserve of hilly grassland with a residence for retired missionary priests, we walked on a wide dirt path. Around us, the grasses and nettles gave off a smell of incense and soap. The insects were loud. Then all at once, they'd stop, like a drop in pressure, leaving the air empty. And then they'd start again, building up. This was snake weather. Snakes might sun themselves on paths. In India, I saw a baby cobra, she said. It was blocking the path, rearing its head up. She made an aspirated noise at the back of her throat. They're the worst. They don't know their power yet. They release the venom all at once. I did not picture my mother in her stories. Instead, I saw her stories from her perspective, as if I had been the one in India with the baby cobra. On the hill above us was a green cactus with bright red fruit. Prickly pears, my mother said. I've been wanting to try one. She began to climb, setting off little avalanches of dirt with her feet. Mom, stop, I said. I'm glad you're not my mother, she said.
Let's do it later, I said.
Come on, Lisa, I've always wanted this.
There's spines, I said.
I wasn't born with yesterday's rain, she said, still climbing. She said this when I acted like a know-it-all. Rain was what we needed. We were in a drought, the worst one in a long time. We weren't supposed to flush after we peed. The hillside was yellow, the sound of the grass crackly under her feet. She made it up to a higher point on the far side of the plant, so she was reaching down from above it. The plant didn't look real, but whimsical, jointed like a plastic doll. Red is a dangerous color in nature, she said, near the bright red fruit. It's a warning color. Poison. Don't eat me. She covered her hand with the edge of her shirt, sucked in her stomach, retched, and grabbed the top of the fruit and pulled. It did not snap off as she thought it would. She began to rotate it. It's fibrous, she grunted. It won't come off. I wanted to make her stop. She was acting crazy, and I hated her. I knew everything. I was full of premonitions. The grasses hissed. Finally, she pried it off and brought it down to the path where I stood. I said, let's take it home and boil it. I want it now, she said. If I can just get the skin off. She used her shirt to guard her hand while she peeled the skin down and then nibbled the flesh at the center, trying to avoid the skin.
Mmm, it's good. Interesting. Want some?
No, thanks, I said. On the drive home, she began to moan.
My throat, she said. It hurts to swallow.
At a stoplight, she pulled herself up in her seat, looked at her open mouth in the rearview mirror. Despite my resolve not to pity her, I was terrified.
I told you to wait, I said.
I know. I can't talk, Lisa. It hurts too much. Small, transparent spines on the skin of the fruit must have lodged themselves along her throat. When we got home, her throat on fire, she went to get her clothes out of the dryer and found that she had accidentally shrunk her favorite Angora sweater.
Damn, she said.
It had a row of mother-of-pearl buttons down the placket.
You can have it.
It fit me exactly, hitting just below my belly button, the sleeves at my wrists, the soft fabric and flower pattern in a sea of pink, as if it were made to be my size. In the few days leading up to the next excursion with Debbie, I was careful not to wear the shrunken sweater, which seemed to be something I had taken from my mother. Part of the tide of good luck that flowed out to me, leaving her behind. A few days later, she sat in her bedroom throwing 3 pennies at the carpet beside a book, a pen, and a piece of paper, consulting the I Ching. She sat in the corner, the lights off. It was daytime, but it was dim in her bedroom. She leaned, her elbow on her knee and her brow in her hand. Strands of hair stuck along her cheek and fell over her ear.
What's wrong? I asked. I lost my 20s, she said.
She threw the pennies again, looked, jotted down ticks as thin as insect legs in a stack that ran down the page, rifled through a small book.
But you did have them, I said.
You have it good, she said. You get to go out with Debbie and have fun. I don't have anyone.
You can come with us, I said, although I knew this wasn't what she wanted.
I want my own friends, my own life.
On the word life, she threw down 3 pennies. We could not both be happy at once. Her eagerness for more life, for fun, the prickly pear, felt to me like danger. My happiness had been pulled from the reserve of hers, a limited string we had to share. If she has it, I must not. If I have it, she must wilt. As if the emotional thrift of the world meant there was never enough for both of us at any one time.
You have friends, I said. This made her sob.
I don't have a man, a husband, a boyfriend, a relationship, nothing.
The air in the bedroom was stale.
But I love you, and I'm here for you.
I try, but nothing works out for me, she went on, as if I hadn't spoken. I used to have these beautiful, strong hands. She was crying so hard there was spit between her lips, and she could hardly get the words out.
And do you know what Faye bought me for Christmas? She said of her stepmother.
It was Jim and Faye whom I called my grandparents, because I'd seen Virginia only a couple of times.
She bought me an iron, she said.
And do you know what she bought Linda?
Linda was her younger sister, the pretty one who'd gotten the paint set. Now Linda was managing several branches of Supercuts and dating a NASA physicist with a mustache and a hot tub.
A champagne bucket, she said.
I knew it was not the utility of the gifts. We used the iron and the ironing board that came with it for years. And later Linda would say it was not a champagne bucket, but an ice bucket, and that she'd specifically asked for it, as my mother had asked for the iron. But the symbolism that made this gift so awful. But still I wanted her to tell Faye about the mistake and make Faye take it back and give her what she wanted. She got up, walked out of her bedroom, grabbed a pair of fabric scissors off her desk in the living room, went to her closet, and began jolting the hangers across the rail, pulling different shirts off hangers and throwing them into a pile.
Don't do it.
Don't tell me what to do. I have nothing to wear. Nothing.
She snipped the corner of an old gray shirt and then ripped it open, revealing a selvage edge.
It's the neckline. It's terrible. I hate my clothes.
She sobbed, then growled. She cut a notch in the bottom of a t-shirt and then took it with both hands and ripped it across, bellowing with rage. She'd done the same with other clothes when she was angry. Cut necklines, shortened shirts and sleeves, then never wore them again. Later, she would have to throw these clothes away, reducing further her already small collection. Around this time, my father threw a large and lavish 30th birthday party for himself. He invited my mother, and she planned to go, inviting Debbie to come along. But as the date approached, she began to waver. She couldn't afford to buy a new dress. She would be ashamed to be there in rags, beside people in finery, celebrating him. She canceled at the last minute, leaving Debbie, who had pinned her hopes of finding a husband on the event, in the lurch. I was not aware of the party at the time, only of my mother's shift into melancholy, and her increasing preoccupation with her wardrobe and her feeling of having lost her youth. I knew the things she didn't like about herself. Her thighs, her forehead, her teeth, the wrinkles above her lip, and that she believed these parts and old clothes meant she would not get what she wanted. In fact, she was beautiful. Her cheekbones high, a delicate nose. She said she, Linda, and Kathy were called the Forehead Sisters in high school, their hairlines starting too high up. But I liked her forehead, bare and smooth like part of an egg. Her figure was like a Rodin sketch I saw later of a woman facing forward looking back, every element feminine and in stunning proportion, back, butt, breasts, a small waist. That night, as she made dinner, she washed the lentils, touching them slowly with the pads of her fingers, looking at them mournfully, as if she were in the process of losing some inestimable thing.
When Debbie and I got back to the house one late afternoon, my mother was waiting for us in front of the garage. I could tell by the way she stood that something was wrong. She held her jaw tight and askew. She held her hand over her eyes to block the sun. I could see she'd been crying. As soon as we got out of the car, she started talking.
You know what? I'm sick of this. How you think you're better than I am?
Mom, I said, stop.
Stay out of this, honey, she said.
Debbie looked innocent, shocked. She edged her way back toward her car door.
Don't pretend you don't know what I'm saying, my mother said.
I don't. I really didn't mean, Debbie stuttered.
You wanted to just march into our lives and judge me in front of my daughter, and you think you're perfect when you're really superficial, silly, my mother said through her teeth.
There was some truth in what my mother said, which made her fury more terrifying.
You're trying to insinuate yourself into Lisa's life to be better than her mother. It's disgusting. Who the hell do you think you are? It's like some kind of molestation.
She was yelling now, her brow and her lips wrinkled like tinfoil. She bared her teeth, and Debbie, startled and balanced too high, her heels clicking, retreated, opening her car door. I was afraid Debbie would think of me as if I was my mother. I imagined others did not see us as separate, but as the same person in two bodies.
Mom, I said.
Be quiet, Lisa, she said. It was hard to move or think. Shock felt like languor. I was ashamed of my mother. How scary she was when she yelled, snarling and unkempt. The scene unfolded like two ribbons. Debbie pleading, my mother responding, fluttering after her to yell more. Debbie retreating, slipping into her car, turning on the engine and driving away. I never saw Debbie again. My mother was supposed to go on a first date with Ron. He would come to pick her up, meet me, and they would go to an early dinner. The neighbors were home if I needed anything. I was old enough now, 7, to stay alone in the house for 2 hours, but the details were still a negotiation. And afterwards, I was supposed to be in bed before she returned.
I guess we might come back, she said.
I made her promise they wouldn't go into her room, and for some reason she agreed. Since she'd become interested in Ron, she no longer paid attention to me as astutely, I thought. She no longer consulted the I Ching. She was half absent with happiness, the same slight smile on her lips as when she ran up the hill to get the prickly pear. It was between boyfriends, between the loneliness and despair that followed one and the lift that began at the next, where I hoped to stay forever. She and I the only team, the real couple. On the night of the date, Ron arrived on time. She was leaning over the bathroom sink doing her makeup when he knocked. I ran to open the door. I saw right away that Ron wasn't a hippie. He was bald, with hair tufted on the sides like a clown's, and had wide, bushy eyebrows, glasses rimmed with gold, and large, swollen lips like a fish. He looked clean and smelled of soap and detergent.
Hello, I said. I'm Lisa. My mom's getting ready.
Nice to meet you, he said, holding out his hand.
He followed me into the living room. I noticed that as he walked, his feet splayed out dramatically to either side. My mother called from the bathroom, I'll be out in a minute. As we passed the bookshelf, I reached for the album of photographs of my birth. This was unplanned. It surprised even me, one arm jutting out as if I didn't have control of my limbs, and pulled it out of its socket in the shelf. I'd asked her to get rid of this album many times, and she refused, bringing it with us as we moved from house to house. The cover was made of brown woven grasses, and because it was old, the grasses had started to fray at the edges. To me, too, this hinted at the shame of the contents.
I suspected other children didn't have shameful books like this around their houses.
He and I sat down on the flowered couch beside each other.
I want to show you something, I said. Just some photos of my mother and me.
I opened the book across my lap where he could see it. My mother, younger, lying on a bed with long hair like dark water pooling around her face. These were the pictures of my birth in black and white with rounded corners. She had what looked like a man's shirt buttoned around her chest, and she was naked from the waist down, with her legs bent and open in the foreground of the photo. I turned the page. There I was, emerging from between her glowing white legs like a turtle rising up from a pond. In the following pictures, once I was out, you could see my body wrinkled, my face wax white, asymmetrical, and squished. I felt revulsion and disgust, and yet I continued to turn the pages. I would not have known how to articulate it. I wanted to disgust him the way I was disgusted, to scare him away, to show him who we were, so that he might leave now rather than wait. "And here's more," I said in my sweetest voice.
"Yes," he said. "I see."
He made no motion to rise and run. He sat, glancing at the pages and then looking away as if distracted. When my mother came out of the bathroom and saw us, she snatched the album from my hands and stuck it back in its place on the shelf, giving me a furious look.
Let's blast.
One of the first memories I have of my father is at a birthday party someone threw for him at a house in Russian Hill. He was in his early 30s. The light was different in San Francisco. We called it the city, slanting and yellow and more watery than it was in Palo Alto. The house, too, was beautiful, tall with soft wool carpets that tucked into the walls and the largest television I'd ever seen. The grass backyard was almost entirely taken up by a trampoline, the large round kind, high up on metal legs. My father was on the trampoline, wearing jeans and a flannel shirt.
"Hey there, want to come bounce?"
he called out to me. I walked over and someone, not my mother, hoisted me, brought me high enough to lift my leg and grasp the fabric lip, my toes curling like a marsupial's. The surface was the size of a small pool and caught light, like an oil slick. I assumed my father and I would bounce the way I'd learned in my gymnastics lessons. But with two people, it was different. The cadence irregular and jostling. Despite my efforts to stay on separate but complementary trajectories, we almost hit each other in mid-air. He wasn't coordinated, didn't have a clear sense of how to fall and rise, nor did the trampoline have netted walls. We might fly off into the lawn where people were standing, or over the fence. I was lighter. I would be the one to fly. Worse, I might land on top of him. My yellow shorts belled out in the updraft, and I worried that he and everyone on the lawn beneath us would see my underwear. But if I held my shorts down, I'd lose the small measure of control I had over my movements. It was not clear when I reached the highest point of up, because inside it was the fall, the pulling feeling of down. Twice we found ourselves coming down to land at the same moment. I prayed we wouldn't touch. It would be too intimate. I was conscious of scrabbling away from accidental closeness in front of strangers. In midair, he looked at me, smiled. My drop, his bounce. His drop, my bounce. From below, someone took a photograph. We kept bouncing until he said, "All right, kid, should we call it a day?" I'd never heard the expression before. Call it a day. My mother told me a story she'd heard about my father that went something like this. My father was adopted, and at some point in his 20s went to look for his birth parents. The search had been fruitless for a while, but finally he found the doctor who had delivered him. Because he'd been looking for so long, he decided this would be his last attempt. If it didn't work, he wasn't meant to find them.
He went to meet with the doctor and asked for the name of his mother. The doctor said he didn't know, but even if he did, he couldn't tell him because it would be a breach of confidentiality. When my father walked out the door of the doctor's office, he decided to stop looking. At the same time, back in the office, the doctor sat down and wrote on a piece of paper, "Upon my death, please tell Steve Jobs I do know his mother, and her name is Joanne." He had her contact information and wrote it out. 4 hours later, the doctor died of a massive coronary attack. My father got the letter, found his mother, and learned that he had a younger sister, Mona. It was easy to get the timing right when you told a story like this, pausing after he stopped looking, lowering your voice to start in on the doomed doctor writing the fateful note. Around the time I turned 8, we moved again, and my father started dropping by our house once or twice a month. By this time, he'd been kicked out of his company, Apple, an event I heard later was deeply hurtful to him. But even then, I could feel that he was profoundly sad in some way that made him walk funny and act aloof. He was in the process of starting a new company called Next that would make computer hardware and software. I knew he also owned a computer animation company called Pixar that made a short film about two lamps, a parent and child. But this seemed minor compared with Apple or Next. Later, my mother said that it was the dips in his worldly success that made him come and find us. The pattern she saw was that when he failed at work, when he lost something in the public sphere, he remembered us, started dropping by, wanted a relationship with me. As if in the flurry of work, he forgot me and remembered only when the flurry stopped. When he came over, we all went roller skating around the neighborhood. My mother came along because I hardly knew him and would have felt strange being alone with him. His visits materialized out of ordinary afternoons. An engine shuddered into our driveway to the bottle brush tree, echoing off our house and the wooden fence on the other side, thickening the air with excitement. He drove a black Porsche convertible. When he stopped, the sound turned into a whine and then was extinguished, leaving the quiet more quiet. The pinpoint sounds of birds. "Hi, Steve," I said. "Hey," he said. I liked the way he walked on the balls of his toes, tilted forward, falling into each step. His outlines were crisp. I anticipated his arrival, wondering when it would happen, and thought about him afterward. But in his presence, for the hour or so we were all together, there was a strange blankness like the air after his engine switched off. He didn't talk much. He and my mother talked some, but there were long pauses. The thunk and whir of roller skates on pavement. The birds and a few cars and leaf blowers. We skated the neighborhood streets. Trees overhead made patterns of the light. Fuchsia dangled from bushes and yards. Stamens below a bell of petals. Like women in ball gowns with purple shoes. Some streets wound around huge oak trees. Some had been cracked by roots and earthquakes, the curvy fissures filled in with shiny black tar. "Look how the tar lines reflect the sky," my mother said to both of us. It was true. They were light blue rivers. During the skates with my father, I was not voluble the way I was when it was just my mother and me. Steve had the same skates as my mother. A beige nubuck body with red laces crisscrossed over a double line of metal fasts. I skated behind her ahead. She talked about the college she wanted to attend in San Francisco. He tripped on cracks in the sidewalk and the roads. To me, skating was easy, like running or swimming. My mother's back brake pad was worn away, and her front brake, the one that looked like a pencil eraser, was down to a slant. She knit the pavement, ankle over ankle, and slowed to a stop in one long line like Fred Astaire. His brakes looked new. "Can you use your brakes?" I asked as we approached a stop sign. "I don't need brakes," he said. He aimed for the pole, hit it straight on with his chest, hugged it with both arms, and twirled around it, indecorously, stepping and stumbling until he stopped.
As we passed bushes in other people's yards, he pulled clumps of leaves off the stems, then dropped the fragments as we skated, making a line of ripped leaves behind us on the pavement like Hansel and Gretel. A few times I felt his eyes on me. When I looked up, he looked away. After he left, we talked about him. "Why do his jeans have holes all over?" I asked. "He might have sewn them up." I knew he was supposed to have millions of dollars. We didn't just say millionaire, but multi-millionaire when we spoke of him, because it was accurate, and because knowing the granular details made us part of it. "In high school, he sometimes had more hole than Jean," she said. "It's just his way. On our first date, when he came to pick me up, my father asked, 'Young man, what are you going to be when you grow up?' And you know what he said?"
"What?"
"A bum." Your grandfather was not pleased. He was hoping for an upstanding man to take his daughter out, and instead he got this long-haired hippie saying he wanted to be a bum. She said my father had a lisp. "It's something to do with his teeth," she said. She said most people have an underbite or an overbite, but his teeth hit each other exactly straight on, and over the years they cracked and chipped where they hit, so the top and bottom teeth meet with no spaces. It looks like a zigzag or a zipper. When they were dating in high school, even before they started selling the blue boxes that let you call anywhere in the world for free, he predicted that he would become famous.
"How did he know?"
"He just did," she said. "He also said he'd die young, in his early 40s. I was pretty sure that since the first prediction was right, the second one would be right too. I began to think of him as a kind of prophet, with loneliness and tragedy at the edges. Only we knew how lonely, how tragic. All light and dark, nothing in between. And he has these strangely flat palms," she said. Every element about him that was different from others meant some sort of divinity, I thought. I assigned mystical qualities to his slouching, falling walk, his zipper teeth, his tattered jeans, his flat palms, as if these were not only different from our fathers, but better. And now that he was in my life, even if it was only once a month, I had not waited in vain. I would be better off than children who'd had fathers all along.
He continued to grow through his 20s, when most people have stopped growing, she said.
I saw it. Of course, the parts did not go together. He was rich, but had holes in his jeans. He was successful, but hardly talked. His figure was graceful, elegant, but he was clumsy and awkward. He was famous, but seemed bereft and alone. He invented a computer and named it after me, but didn't seem to notice me, and didn't mention it. Still, I could see how all these contrasting qualities could be an attribute, spun in a certain way.
"I heard when it gets a scratch, he buys a new one," I overheard my mother say to Ron.
"A new what?" I asked.
"Porsche."
"Couldn't he just paint over the scratch?" I asked.
"Car paint doesn't work like that," Ron said. "You can't just paint over black with black. It wouldn't blend. There are thousands of different blacks. They'd have to repaint the whole thing."
The next time he came over, I wondered if it was the same car he'd been driving the last time, or if it was a new one that just looked the same. One day he came over and brought someone with him. She was petite and pretty, wore jeans, had red hair that fell in a line below her jaw, large, dark blue eyes, and a wide mouth that took over her face in a pleasing way when she smiled.
"This is my sister," he said.
She was an author, Mona Simpson. After giving my father up for adoption, his biological parents got married, had a daughter a few years later, and kept her. She and my father were soon close, kindred spirits, alike, even though they'd just met. She had just published her first novel, Anywhere But Here,
a book that would be on the bestseller list for many weeks and would become a movie starring Susan Sarandon and Natalie Portman. I read it when I was 12. It was brilliant. Stephen Monnot looked different. Tall and petite, dark and light, man and woman. You couldn't tell they were brother and sister until they both smiled and their faces opened and folded in the same way. They had similar lips and wide teeth. That my father's sister happened to be named Mona struck me as a great coincidence. What were the chances that she would have a name that went so well with mine as to form, in combination, the name of the most famous painting in the world? They'd both been successful on their own, neither knowing of the other's existence. They shared an aesthetic sensibility, my father buying expensive lamps, carpets, and books, while Mona patrolled flea markets for vintage mercury bulbs, wooden figures, magnolia-patterned plates, glasses with a stripe of silver painted on the rim. Later, it was Mona who insisted that he rent us a nicer house than our tiny one on Melville, who insisted that he recarpet and paint the small apartment within the Woodside house where he slept and I slept when I stayed with him, and that he change my bedroom from the one with the red shag rug, which required me to walk through his room to get to the bathroom, to one beside the bathroom. She who bought me a bed, and later argued that he should buy my mother and me a house. She was supportive of my mother's artwork and took intense interest in the details of my life in a way that seemed to elevate them. When Mona visited, she brought with her excitement about food, jewelry, clothing. She would find the good restaurants, the places that served the best pie. She wore the same pair of earrings always that looked like a long drip of gold on each ear, the front and back sides hitting below her jawline. Mona had also grown up with a single mother after her father left. It seemed to me that her mother was unhinged, from stories I insisted she'd tell me later. One Christmas, her mother had bought gifts for her boyfriend's children, but not for Mona. Once she'd made her order the steak at a restaurant when they didn't have the money for it. Mona's stories gave me a thrill like looking down a steep cliff face, close to danger, but safe at the same time. Mona took an interest in me. She noticed and commented on my tastes, judged me wise, gave me a first gift, the Arabian Nights. Mona gazed at me as if she was particularly interested in my face. She watched me sometimes, even when she was conversing with the adults. At a restaurant, I doodled on a paper placemat, and she pronounced it great, took it, framed it, and put it up in her apartment in New York. I would grow to be the same height as Mona, and also petite. I would also study English literature in college and write. One year, she wrote me long letters every week on thick paper in sepia ink. She gave me adult gifts. Silver-pointed dangly earrings, a set of collected Chekhov stories in pastel-colored paperbacks, a gold Tiffany ring with an amethyst eye. These gifts were windows into a more sophisticated world to which I hoped I'd belong later. She had survived her own childhood and now was successful. The gifts were proof of that. When I was a senior in high school, she would publish a new book. Before it was published, she sent me the bound galleys and asked me what I thought of the novel, if there was anything I would change. I was honored. But when I started reading, I was surprised to find characters like my father, my mother, and myself in the pages. My character was named Jane. I'd had no idea she was writing about us. Mona had collected details of my life and put them into her book. An antique Chinese enameled pillbox she bought for me, with chrysanthemums and multicolored birds painted on a blue background. Other parts were made up. It was fiction. And the combination was confusing. At first, I'd felt hurt to find my things on the pages, as if she'd taken the gifts back. Still, when I read Mona's books, they made me want to write my own sentences. People write about family in fictional form, she said. Fiction writers use details from life. We were at Cafe Verona, where we'd gone to talk about it. When she'd learned I was upset after reading the galleys, She flew to Palo Alto the next day from where she lived in Los Angeles to talk with me.
It's just what writers do. I didn't mean to upset you. Not at all.
Reading her book, I felt there would be nothing left for me to write about. I felt emptied out. Jane didn't like sushi because it felt like a tongue on her tongue. The details she described made me disconsolate, as if, having described them so well, they belonged to her now, not to me.
"Why didn't you tell me right after you read it?" she asked. "I would have changed it, or waited, or not even published at all."
But at 18, the idea that I could have told her what to do with her work had not felt possible. Now the book was almost on the shelves. Also, after reading half the book, I'd stopped. I didn't even know what happened with my character in the end.
"You haven't finished?" she asked. "You'll like it. What happens to Jane?"
"Maybe," I said.
"Perhaps you'll mention my book in your book someday," she said,
surprising me with the idea that one book might refer to another like Russian dolls, and that there might be room for more than one book about the same people and the same time. In the end, Jane is wearing a school uniform and she rushes into a classroom with the other children. She finally belongs. Ron thought my private school was elitist and lacked academic rigor. And he managed to convince my mother, too. So we moved house in order to be in the Palo Alto School District so I could attend public school. Our new place, an apartment in the back of another house, was less than half the size of the small house we'd moved from, but with just as many rooms. It was like a playhouse. The wooden floor, newly sanded and varnished for our arrival, yellow as hay, shone like it was wet. Before this, we'd lived on a series of old wall-to-wall carpets, and my mother's joy about this floor surprised me. She reassembled the tubular bed in my new room. One night, soon after we moved in, she rented Desperately Seeking Susan to watch on our new television. I wasn't allowed to watch it. Before this, we hadn't owned a television. After she put me to bed, I turned myself so my head was where my feet usually were, careful not to jostle the singing springs. From there, I could open the door a crack and see the screen over the back of the couch. In the movie, a woman wore tattered black clothing, her hair in spikes, necklaces layered. The more I watched, the more I knew I wanted to look like this woman. My mother spun around and caught me watching.
"I thought so," she said. "Get to sleep."
She came over and shut the door. A few days later, I found a picture in a magazine. It might have been an ad for Guess or Jordache jeans, in which a woman with short, tousled hair, wet maybe, was leaping. She flew above the dark asphalt, toes pointed, perfect splits in the air. She wore a t-shirt and stone-washed jeans. I wanted to be that girl, too. Ron came over while my mother and I were standing in the kitchen. The kitchen alcove was straight across from the front door. When he stepped in, he lifted his camera to his eye.
"Don't move," he said, clicking. "This is really good."
We didn't own a camera. At first, the shots were candid. But now he wanted us to pose. Click, click, click. I could feel my smile hardening. In his interactions with me and my mother, he often insisted too much. My mother said he went too far. As if only by extreme repetition would he be noticed. I knew Ron was kind. He'd bought us matching gold necklaces, hers wider and thicker than mine, made of two rows of jointed segments that met like herringbone. It was only because he went on too long and didn't listen that we became infuriated and pushed him away. Now in the kitchen, it was my mother and me against his frantic urgency. We gave him insolent looks. He turned on the flash.
"Ron, enough," my mother said. "We're done, okay?"
My mother ran into the bathroom. I ducked behind the wall.
"Guys, come back," he said. "Let me take just a few more."
When Ron didn't stay over, I slept with my mother in her bed, which I preferred to sleeping alone. "Why don't you leave him?" I asked her the next day.
"I just might," she said. Ron brought over the developed photographs in a paper envelope. As soon as he stepped inside, my mother grabbed the envelope out of his hand and ran to the couch and started looking through the stack. I tried to get at the pictures, and so did he, but her back was curved against us as she flipped through them, yanking out the photos she didn't like and hiding them in a pile beneath her leg. She had long believed that the essential perspective of the photographer was captured in his or her photographs. Flattering or interesting pictures would mean that Ron noticed her beauty, and even her soul. Ugly pictures would reveal that he did not see, appreciate, or love her. "Let me see," I said, reaching around her, trying to grab them, but it was too late. She ripped the photographs beneath her leg in half. She turned and shrugged, tilted her head, lifted her eyebrows, acknowledging our anger and frustration, but smug, the way she always was when she ripped up photographs of herself. It enraged me when she did this. I became more critical of her. I noticed the way she walked with her toes pointing in, and how her pinky toes formed yellow calluses sharp as blades that ran vertically along the bottom pad where the toes had been flattened in shoes. She added flakes of brewer's yeast to her salads, and they smelled of dusty rooms. Her cakes collapsed with fault lines because she was too impatient to let them cool. Once, I had loved the way the tip of her nose bobbed up and down when she chewed, and sat in her lap to be closer to the sound, like a blade through tall grasses. But now both her nose and her chewing seemed strange and wrong. All these factors, I believed, were why she was only able to date someone like Ron, not my father. I came to believe it was her fault. She wasn't beautiful enough, and was therefore unloved, unlovable. And might make me so, too. At my new school, the buildings were single-story and Spanish style with dirty stucco walls, arches, and courtyards. The hallways between classrooms were open to the elements, covered by porticos, and paved with shiny cement squares. On rainy days, the water poured into the courtyards and over the fenced field at the back of the school. My teacher, Miss Johnson, was young. It was her first year teaching. Her hair fell in a perfect blonde curtain around her face, and her bangs were curled in toward her forehead. When she smiled, cushioned circles formed in her lower cheeks, as if she were holding something delicious in her mouth. I didn't know the Pledge of Allegiance. The first time the class stood to recite it, I tried to mouth the words. Only one girl stayed seated. She sat as if she meant to sit, not as if she'd forgotten to stand. "I'm a Jehovah's Witness," she said. After that, I stayed seated too. "Why aren't you standing for the pledge?" Miss Johnson asked. "I'm a Buddhist," I said. That was the religion my mother said she and my father had practiced. "Oh," she said, and didn't ask me about it again. "It's not just parents who decide to have children," my mother said. I was pretty sure this came from Buddhism. "Some say children choose the parents too, before they're born." I tried to take stock of what I'd chosen. My father far away, glinting like a shard of mirror. My mother so close and urgent. If it was true that I chose my parents, I would choose them again, I thought. At school, I wasn't supposed to mention my father. "You could be kidnapped," Ron said. In high school, my mother knew of a girl abducted in a windowless white van, her hands and legs tied up. After they'd driven her outside the town, they'd stopped at a gas station, and the girl had managed to open the door and get free. I understood in some vague way that I could be kidnapped because of my father, but because he wasn't part of my life in a daily way, the idea seemed far-fetched and glamorous. At Ron's urging, my mother and I went to the police station, where they took my fingerprints. A man dipped my finger in thick, black liquid, pressed it down on paper from one side of the nail bed to the other, hurting me a little each time as he tried to grip my small fingers and roll them, leaving a pattern of lines on the paper my mother said were unique to me. "Whorls," she said they were called. She showed me how hers resolved in a perfect circle, like a topographic map of a hill.
I have a secret, I said to my new friends at school. I whispered it so they would see I was reluctant to mention it. The key, I felt, was to underplay. My father is Steve Jobs.
Who's that?
One asked. He's famous, I said. He invented the personal computer. He lives in a mansion and drives a Porsche convertible. He buys a new one every time it gets a scratch. The story had a film of unreality to it as I said it, even to my own ears. I hadn't hung out with him that much, only a few skates and visits. I didn't have the clothes or the bike someone with a father like this would have. My last name was different from his. He even named a computer after me, I said to them.
What computer? A girl named Elizabeth asked.
The Lisa, I said.
A computer called the Lisa? She said.
I never heard of it.
It was ahead of its time.
I used my mother's phrase, although I wasn't sure why it was ahead. He invented the personal computer later. But you can't tell anyone. Because if someone finds out, I could get kidnapped.
I brought it up when I felt I needed to, waiting as long as I could, and then letting it burst forth. I don't remember feeling at a disadvantage with my friends who had fathers, only that there was at my fingertips another magical identity, an extra thing that started to itch and tingle when I felt small, and it was like pressure building inside me, and then I had to find a way to say it. At some point, I also heard that he'd been named Playboy's Sexiest Man of the Year. I bragged about it selectively because I wasn't sure whether it was true or exactly what it meant. I had gathered that there was a Playboy and also a Playgirl, so I didn't know if he was featured in a magazine of naked women meant for men, or if he was nude himself in a magazine of naked men meant for women. From this, I concluded that my father might be naked in Playboy, and when I thought of it, I got a terrible shiver, and I thought part of growing up would be to take this fact in stride. One of the girls at school, Kirsten, started following me around outside class, chanting, "Your dad is Steve Jobs. Your dad is Steve Jobs."
"Stop it," I said. She didn't stop. She said it sometimes tauntingly, sometimes in a monotone like a robot. It was annoying. But the advantage to her harassment was that it advertised the very fact I wanted known. She did the brag work for me, and I seemed innocent, even put upon as she did it. "What's wrong with that girl?" my mother said when I told her. "I bet it's her parents. They care. I wonder how she found out." I told her I might have been the one to tell her accidentally.
"You told her?"
"It slipped out." I braced for her anger, but instead she was only confused.
"That makes even less sense," she said. "You told her, and now she goes around telling you? Tell her to stop. What a strange girl."
One afternoon when he came for a skate, my father brought over a stack of 6 stickers from his company Next. These were beautiful, thick, large, made of a rigid clear plastic, printed with a black cube, and brightly colored letters.
"You can give these to your friends at school," he said.
I was thrilled. When I gave them out, they would know I hadn't made them up. This was the same time I guessed the number of corn kernels in a jar as part of an activity Miss Johnson called guesstimation. It was the second time in a row I'd guessed the number within a few kernels, even though I'd just written a series of numbers I couldn't have put into words because I didn't understand place order. When my mother came to pick me up, both she and Miss Johnson looked at me curiously, as if I was a secret prodigy. A week later, a poem I wrote was selected for publication in the weekly school newsletter. "The pilgrims are so pretty. The pilgrims are so grand. They sailed here on the Mayflower and walked upon our land." Everything was finally coming together. I was becoming the girl I wanted to be, famous like my father, and lucky. Soon after that, my father brought over a Macintosh computer. He pulled the box out of the back seat and carried it into my room and put it on the floor.
Let's see, he said. How do we open it?
As if he didn't know. This made me doubt he was the inventor. The room had only the loft bed on the bright wooden floor. Parallelograms of light shone in from the window, lit dust twirling like sparks in midair. He pulled the computer out of the box by a handle on the top and set it on the floor near the outlet on the wall.
I guess we plug this in.
He held the cord loose like it was unfamiliar. He sat on the floor in front of it with his legs crossed. I sat on my knees beside him. He looked for the on switch, found it, and the machine came alive to reveal a picture of itself in the center, smiling. He showed me how I could draw with it and save my drawings on the desktop once I was finished with them, and then he left. He didn't mention the other one, the Lisa. I worried that he had not really named a computer after me, that it was a mistake.
You want to make kids like you? Tell them you went to NASA and played with the flight simulators. That's what'll make them jealous, Ron said.
He worked as an engineer for NASA's Ames Research Center, so he could get us in. On the day we finally went, after he'd talked about it for months, the sun was blazingly hot and the white rocks outside the tinted glass door radiated heat. He took my picture beside the NASA sign, and then inside at the reception desk, and then again outside the door to the simulators. I'd recently had my hair cut straight across my chin at Supercuts, where we got a discount because my Aunt Linda was a manager. Inside, the simulator wasn't working.
Damn, he said. The one day we come, what are the chances?
It didn't look like an airplane, but like an office. There were yellow and blue levers embedded in the desks near the keyboards. The screens remained black.
These simulators are so incredible. It's just like flying, he'd said.
When he talked about it, I wondered, would it really feel like flying with wind? And if I crashed the flight simulator, would I feel as if I were falling?
Look at the screen and pretend you're really concentrating, he said,
the camera against his eye, taking picture after picture.
And pull down the lever at the same time. That's it. You can tell your friends at school that the screens didn't show up because of the flash.
He took me to lunch at a place with white tablecloths and water poured from silver pitchers into wine glasses. He apologized for how disappointing it was that the simulation hadn't worked. I told him it was okay. He took more pictures of me elbowing the table and taking sips of water and smiling until the food arrived and we ate. That night I wrote in my journal that I loved my dad. Then I clarified. Not Ron, Steve Jobs. Underneath the name Steve Jobs, I wrote, I love him, I love him, I love him. I felt it there inside my chest like my heart would rip apart with it. My mother was admitted into California College of Arts and Crafts in San Francisco, where she would work toward her bachelor's degree. My father offered to take me on Wednesday nights, the only night of the week she had class. I would be alone with him for the first time. We would sleep at his mansion, with its glowing white face and 7 acres. It gave me a shiver of excitement and disbelief, sitting in school that first Wednesday. My new fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Keatsman, sat at the front of the class and twisted a snug gold ring around and around her finger when she was upset with us for being unruly, the flesh tugging near the band. At the end of the day, I ran outside at the bell, the first one, and looked for the white Honda Civic I'd been told to watch for. Barbara, my father's secretary, would pick me up. She was parked against the curb in front of the school. She leaned over and rolled down the window.
Lisa?
Barbara?
That's me,
she said, opening the latch of the passenger side door. She drove us to my father's office. Her fingernails on the stick shift were painted red, and she wore a long skirt and a blouse with 2 sections of cloth at the collar that tied in a bow. Her brown hair fell straight in a glossy line that almost hit her shoulders. She wore glasses. I liked being near her. I realized later this was true of the people I knew who worked with my father during the years I was growing up. They were kind and gentle.
Often I felt more at home with them than I did with my father. They seemed soulful and modest. I think he must have admired these qualities and chosen them, even though he was not always like that himself. Barbara had a matronly presence, calm and mature, although she couldn't have been much older than my mother. I sat on the carpeted floor in the middle of a huge room with a few low couches, large cement pillars painted white, a plant, and offices around the outside windowed wall of the building. The room smelled like new paint and carpet. Barbara brought me paper and an assortment of pens. From the place where I sat, I could see my father's office across the expansive floor, the same size as all the offices around him, the door open. I could hear him talking on the phone. People would walk into his office, talk with him for a while, and then stop and say hello to me and ask if I was all set and look at my drawings. I couldn't see him behind his desk because there was a Venetian blind, mostly closed, on the window that faced into the central room. But I could hear him, and sometimes he would walk out of his office, waving and smiling at me, and I'd think that maybe we were leaving, but then he'd return to his office again. All the offices had whiteboards. When he was speaking with someone else, he spoke very fast and loud. His office began to glow brightly along with several other offices along the same wall, lighter as it grew dark outside. "I want to show you something," he said at some point, walking up to me. "Leave your backpack." I followed him down the stairs into another set of closed rooms. We passed a wall with a whiteboard with names and photographs with numbers beside them. "At other companies, they try to hide what people are earning, and it's this big secret," he said. "We just write it here, and everyone can see it. It stops all the stupid gossip." I followed him down into a basement office with a bunch of desks, a low ceiling, lots of computers, and a few men standing around. Most of the people must have already gone home. He introduced me as his daughter, and then they started talking to each other rapidly, and I couldn't understand what they were talking about. "Look at this," he said to me, pointing at a computer with a large screen. "And this, and this. It's like they have a blind midget on the assembly line." He was pointing to Sun Microsystems logos on big monitors, each attached at a different place along the panel at the bottom of the screen. His voice was so sharp that I wondered why they bought them at all. "We need them to make ours," he said. "So computers make computers," I thought. After that, we said goodbye to the men and walked back up the stairs. I figured we'd head out now, but he left me near my backpack and went back to his office. Soon he was back on the phone.
"Ready to go, champ?"
By this time, it was night. Barbara had already left. Before saying goodbye, she held her purse against her lap and squatted down to ask me about my drawings. I was woozy with Fanta from the stocked refrigerator. The thought of going with my father to his big house, alone in the dark, was unsettling. I hadn't considered the possibility that we'd still be far away from his house, not inside it, when darkness fell. The town of Woodside, a 20-minute drive from Palo Alto, was a place with forests and people who owned horses. His house was a mansion built on 7 acres of land. This phrase, 7 acres, seemed vast and grand, more grand than anything I knew. The house was Spanish style, white stucco, with an old metal gate at the front with a lock strung through that had to be opened by hand, and a flagpole with no flag. The rooms were large and dark and empty, with huge windows on both sides that nevertheless did not let much light in. I knew this from the time I'd been there with him and my mother years before, in the daytime, soon after he'd bought it. This time he'd said to bring along my bathing suit, just in case, but remembering that dark pool in the middle of the ragged field from years before terrified me now. Would it be filled with dead bugs and dead animals? Along with the fear was something else, a kind of ecstatic expectation. For on this night, at some moment I couldn't predict, he'd say, "Let's blast," and we'd walk down that wide staircase through the chemical smell of new textiles and out into the sweet-smelling night air. We'd get into his car, and it would wheeze and rumble the way it did. And for the first time, there would be no one but the two of us, heading for his mansion on the 7 acres of land. We drove with the top down, the heat blasting.